The hunters had killed more than 40 large animals, so it was a few days before all the carcasses could be butchered, the meat smoked and packed aboard the barges. Only then could they board the galleys and continue the voyage southward. When Tinat was back with his officers, he became aloof and unapproachable once more. Watching him with the inner eye, Taita saw that he was regretting their conversation and the disclosures he had made. He was fearful of the consequences of his indiscretion. The wind veered into the north and freshened. The galleys shipped their oars and hoisted large lateen sails. White water curled under their prows, and the shore flew by on the starboard side. On the fifth morning after the hunt, they reached the mouth of another tributary. Coming down from the high ground to the west, it poured an enormous volume of water into the lake. Taita heard the crew talking among themselves, and the name Kitanguli banded about. Clearly that was the name of the river before them. He was not surprised when the captain ordered the sail to be lowered and the oars run out once more. Their galley led the flotilla into the Kitanguli and pushed against the mighty flow. Within a few leagues, they had come to a large settlement built along the riverbank. Here there were shipyards with the unfinished hulls of two large vessels lying on the slipways. Workmen swarmed over them, and Taita pointed out the overseers to Merrin. "That accounts for the foreign design of the ships in the squadron. All must have been built in these yards, and those who built them are unmistakably from the lands beyond the Indus." "How came they to this place, so far from their own land?" Merrin wondered. "There is something here that attracts worthy men from afar, like bees to a garden of flowers." "Are we bees also, Magus? Does the same attraction entice us?" Taita looked at him with surprise. This was an unusually perceptive idea from Merrin. "We have come here to fulfil a sacred oath made to Pharaoh," he reminded him. "However, now that we have arrived, we must be on our guard. We must never allow ourselves to be turned into dreamers and lotus-eaters, as it seems so many of these Jarians are." The flotilla sailed on up the river. Within days they had encountered the first cataracts of white water that blocked the river from bank to bank. This did not daunt Tinat and his captains, for at the foot of the torrent there was another small village, and beyond that extensive cattle stockades which held herds of humped oxen. Passengers, horses, and slaves disembarked onto the bank. With only the crew still on board, the vessels were hitched with heavy ropes of twisted liana to teams of oxen and dragged up the chutes of fast water. Ashore, the men and horses climbed the track that ran beside the cascade until they reached higher ground. Above the cataracts, the river was deep and placid, and the galleys rode lightly at anchor. All embarked again, to voyage on until they reached the next waterfall, where the procedure was repeated. Three times they came to falls, too steep and furious to permit the vessels to be dragged up them. Egyptian engineering genius was evident in the extensive works that circumvented the obstacles. A zigzag series of channels had been dug alongside the falls, with locks at each end, and wooden gates to lift the vessels to the next level. It took many days and much labour to bring the flotilla up the water ladders, but eventually they were in the deep, gentle flow of the main stream once more. Since leaving the lake, the terrain they had passed through was fascinating in its magnificent diversity. For 100 leagues or so after they had entered the Kitanguli, the river ran through dense jungle. Branches almost met overhead, and it seemed that no two trees were of the same species. They were festooned with lianas, other vines, and flowering creepers. High in the canopy, troops of monkeys squabbled noisily in gardens of flowering orchids and fruit. Glistening monitor lizards sunned themselves on branches that overhung the river. At the approach of the boats, they launched themselves into the air and fell to hit the water with a splash that showered the men at the oars. At night, when they moored along the bank, tied to the trunks of the great trees, the darkness was loud with the cries and scuffling of unseen animals and the roars of the predators that hunted them. Some of the crew set fishing lines in the black water, the bronze hooks baited with offal. 3 men on one line struggled to pull out the huge catfish that seized the bait. Slowly, the vegetation along the banks changed as they climbed up through the cataracts. The sweltering heat cooled, and the air became more salubrious. Once they had negotiated the final water ladder, they found themselves in an undulating landscape of grassy glades and open forests dominated by many species of acacia, leafless and thorny, covered with soft feathery foliage, with vast black trunks and dark boughs. The tallest were decorated with bunches of lavender fruit hanging like grapes from the high branches. This was a fertile, well-watered land with lush sweet grass filling the glades and dozens of streams joining the main flow of the Kitangule. The plains swarmed with herds of grazing animals, and not a day passed when they did not see prides of lions hunting or resting in the open. At night their thunderous roars were terrifying. No matter how often they heard them, the listeners' nerves jangled and their hearts raced. At last a tall escarpment rose across the horizon, and they were aware of a murmur that grew louder as they drew closer. They came round another bend in the river and saw before them a mighty waterfall that fell in thundering gouts of white foam from the top of a cliff into a swirling green pool at the foot. On the beaches that surrounded it, teams of oxen were standing ready to draw the boats ashore. Once again they disembarked, but this was for the last time. No device of man could lift the vessels to the top of those cliffs. In the settlement on the river bank, there were guest houses to accommodate the officers and Taita's party, while the rest of the men, horses and baggage, were brought ashore. The Basmara slaves were locked into barracoons. It was 3 days before Colonel Tinat was ready to continue the journey. Now all of the baggage was loaded onto pack oxen. The slaves were led out of the barracoons and roped together in long lines. The troopers and Taita's band mounted and rode out along the base of the cliff in a long caravan. Within a league, the road was climbing sharply up the escarpment in a series of hairpin bends and narrowed to a path. The gradient became so steep that they were forced to dismount and lead the horses, the heavily laden oxen, and the slaves toiling behind them. Halfway up the cliff they reached a place where a narrow rope suspension bridge crossed a deep gorge. Captain Onker took control of the crossing, allowing only a small number of pack animals and men to venture out onto the precarious structure at a time. Even with a limited load, the bridge swayed and sagged alarmingly, and it was the middle of the afternoon before the caravan was across the gorge. "Is this the only route to the top of the cliffs?" Merrin asked Onker. "There is an easier road that scales the escarpment 40 leagues to the south, but it adds several days' travel to the journey." Once they were across the void, they looked down and their view seemed to encompass the earth. From on high they surveyed golden savannas over which the rivers crawled like dark serpents, distant blue hills and green jungles. Finally, on the misty horizon, the waters of the great lake Nalubala, along which they had sailed, gleamed like molten metal. At last they reached the border fort, perched on the ridge to guard the pass, the Kitangula Gap, and the entrance to Jari. It was dark by the time they bivouacked outside it. It rained during the night, but by morning the sun was shining benevolently. When they looked out of their shelter, Taita and Fenn were presented with a sight that made all the splendours they had seen up to then seem commonplace. Below them lay a wide plateau that stretched to a distant horizon. Along it rose a range of rugged mountains so tall they must have been the abode of the gods. 3 central peaks shone with the ethereal luminance of the full moon. Taita and Merrin had travelled through the peaks along the Khorasan Highway, but Fenn had never seen snow before. She was struck dumb by the glorious sight. At last she found her voice. "Look! The mountains are on fire," she cried. From the summit of each shining mountain billowed silver clouds of smoke. "You were seeking a single volcano, Magus," Merrin said softly, "but you have found 3. He turned and pointed back at the distant shimmer of Lake Nalubala on the far side of the pass. "Fire, air, water, and earth. But the lord of these is fire," Taita finished the incantation of Eos. "Surely that must be the stronghold of the witch." His legs were trembling, and he was overcome with emotion. They had come so far, and endured such hardship to reach this place. He had to find somewhere to sit, for his legs could hardly bear his weight. He found a vantage point from which he could gaze upon the sight. Fenn sat on the rock beside him to share his emotions. At last Captain Onker rode back from the head of the caravan to find them. "You may linger here no longer. We must move on." The road descended at an easier gradient. They mounted the horses and rode down through the foothills and onto the plateau. For the rest of that day they travelled towards the mountains, through an enchanted land. They had climbed just high enough above the lake, the jungles and deserts, to reach this sweet, benevolent clime. Each breath they drew seemed to charge their bodies and clear their minds. Streams of clear water ran down from the mountains. They passed cottages and farms built of stone with golden thatch, surrounded by orchards and olive groves. There were meticulously tended vineyards, where the vines were heavy with ripening grapes. The fields were planted with durra, the vegetable gardens with melons, beans, lentils, red and green peppers, pumpkins, and other vegetables that Taita did not recognize. The pastures were green, and herds of cattle, sheep, and goats grazed in them. Fat pigs rooted in the forests, ducks and geese paddled in river pools, and flocks of chickens scratched in every farmyard. "Seldom in all our travels have we come upon such rich lands," Merrin said. As they passed, the farmers and their families came out to welcome them with bowls of sherbet and red wine. They spoke Egyptian with the accents of the two kingdoms. They were all well nourished and dressed in good leather and linen. The children appeared healthy, but they were strangely subdued. The women were rosy-cheeked and well-favoured. "What pretty girls," Merrin remarked. "Not an ugly one among them." They soon found out why the pastures were so green. Suddenly the triple peaks of the snow-decked volcanoes were hidden behind a heavy layer of cloud. Onker rode back to them and told Taita, "You should don your capes. It'll rain within the hour." "How do you know?" Taita asked. "Because it rains every afternoon at this time," he pointed ahead at the gathering clouds. "The three peaks that dominate Jari have many names, one of which is the Rainmakers. They are the reason why the land is so bounteous." As he finished speaking, rain swept over them, and despite their capes, soaked them to the skin. But within a few hours the clouds had been blown aside, and the sun shone once more. The land was washed clean and bright. The leaves on the trees glistened, and the soil smelt of rich durra cake. They came to a fork in the road. The column of slaves took the left-hand path, and as they marched away, Taita heard a sergeant of the escort remark, "They are sorely needed in the new mines at Indebi." The rest of the convoy continued along the right fork. At intervals the troopers came to salute Colonel Tinat, then left the column and rode away in different directions to their home farms. In the end, only Tinat and Onker, with an escort of 10 troopers, remained with them. It was late afternoon when they topped a gentle rise and discovered another small village nestled below them among green trees and pastures. "This is Mutangi," Tinat told Taita. "It is the local market town and magistracy. It will be your home for the time being. Quarters have been set aside for you, and I'm sure you will find them comfortable. You have heard it said before, but you are honoured guests in Jari." The magistrate came out in person to welcome them, a man of middle age named Bilto. His full beard was tinged with silver, but he was straight and strong, his eye steady and his smile warm. Taita looked at him with the inner eye and saw that he was honest and well-intentioned, but like Colonel Tinat Ankut, he was neither happy nor contented. He greeted Taita with the greatest respect, but looked at him strangely, as though he was expecting something from him. One of his own wives took Hilto and the others, including Nakonto and Imbali, to a commodious stone house near the far side of the village, where slave girls were waiting to attend to them. Bilto led Taita, Fenn, and Merrin to a larger building across the road. "I think you will find all you need for your comfort. Rest and refresh yourselves. Within the next few days the Council of Oligarchs will send for you. In the meantime, I am your host, and yours to command." Before he left them, Bilto looked again at Taita with troubled, searching eyes, but he said no more. When they entered the house, a major domo and 5 house slaves were lined up to receive them. The rooms were large and airy, but the windows could be covered with leather curtains, and there were open hearths in the main rooms where fires were already burning. Although the sun was still above the horizon, there was a chill in the air, so the fires would be welcome when the sun set. Fresh clothes and sandals had been laid out for them, and the slaves brought jars of hot water for washing. The evening meal was served by the light of oil lamps, a rich stew of wild boar chops washed down with a robust red wine. Until then, they had not realized that the journey had exhausted them. Meron's eye was paining him, so Taita poured a warm balm of olive oil and soothing herbs into the socket, then administered a dose of red shepan. The next morning they all slept late. Meron's eye had improved, but still hurt. After breakfast, Bilto took them on a tour of the village, of which he was proud, and explained how the community lived. He introduced them to the leaders, and Taita found in the main that they were honest and uncomplicated. He had expected to detect some ambiguity in their psyches, as he had with Bilto and Colonel Tinat, which might be attributed to the proximity and influence of Eos, but there was nothing of significance, just the petty foibles and frailties of humanity. One was discontented with his wife, another had stolen an axe from his neighbour and was consumed with guilt, while someone else lusted for his young stepdaughter. Early in the morning of the fifth day, Captain Onker returned to Mutangi to deliver a summons from the Supreme Council. They were to leave at once, he told them.